Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
In 1996, a 12-year-old Asian boy with a bowl haircut, his body hugged by a jumpsuit, walked into a boarding school in Bern, Switzerland. He was, by all appearances, just another spoiled rich kid. He loved action movies and airplanes. He was obsessed with basketball, especially the Chicago Bulls. Each new academic year, he was the envy of the class, strutting around the schoolyard in a pair of freshly unboxed Air Jordans. According to classmates, the boy answered to the name Pagun. But what they didn't know is that Swiss authorities had a different name on file. According to the kid's Brazilian passport, his real name was Joseph Puag. But here's the secret. Neither name was real. Joseph Puag and Pagun were just aliases. The 12-year-old's real name was Kim Jong-un. And for the next 4 years, the Michael Jordan-loving son of a tyrant would use these phony personas to conceal his identity and gallivant around Europe undetected, just like his older brother. But what's most fascinating about Kim Jong-un's fake Brazilian passport isn't the alias or the country of origin. What's most intriguing is that the document lists his father as a man called Ricardo Puag. Who was he? Well, Ricardo Puag was a real person, at least the fake name of a real person. But we know that he was a top-level North Korean official, one who traveled to Europe regularly, often staying in luxury hotels. According to Anna Fifield's book, Ricardo was, quote, charged with buying buildings for the North Korean ruling class. And if that's any indication, we have a good idea about the man's real identity.
We don't know for sure who Ricardo Puag was, but there has been suggestion that Jang Song-taek was that person.
Jang Song-taek, the uncle of both Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-nam, widely considered one of the most influential people in the regime.
Jang Song-taek's role in the regime was to go out into the world. He was a very mercurial, gregarious character, and he was in charge of a lot of economic liaison with the outside world, mostly with China, but he also traveled quite a lot in Europe.
In the 90s, Jang Song-taek was one of the most powerful men in North Korea. Decades earlier, he had married Kim Jong-il's sister and became a close confidant to the dear leader. He was always on the move, traveling the world undercover, securing deals to help fund the regime. He was so powerful that, as you may remember, some pundits called him, quote, the Kim Jong-il who goes abroad. It's hard to overstate how close Kim Jong-il and Jang Song-taek were. He acted as a father figure to the supreme leader's children, Chang even personally held auditions for the women in Kim Jong-il's harem. And during the 2000s, some North Korea watchers speculated that Chang could be chosen to lead the nation. Of course, that honor would go to Chang's, or should we say, Ricardo Puag's, fake Brazilian son. But that decision didn't neuter Uncle Chang's power. Because when Kim Jong-un took over in 2011, it was Chang who helped shepherd his nephew through North Korea's bureaucracy. It was Chang who helped him build relationships with the Politburo. It was Chang who built apartments and resorts to glorify the new ruler. And it was Chang who served as Kim Jong-un's closest advisor. By 2013, Chang Sung-taek essentially functioned as Kim Jong-un's chief of staff. The two were like father and son, like Ricardo and Joseph Puag. But Uncle Chang harbored a secret, one that linked him to Kim Jong-nam, and one that would reportedly soon have him staring down the barrel of an anti-aircraft gun. I'm Eden Lee, and in this episode, dirty money, risky reform, and failed coups. Inside the money-making schemes that may have led several members of the Kim dynasty to gamble with their lives.
There are also plenty of suggestions that he was still in cahoots with the regime.
North Korean diplomats stationed abroad have really behaved like a criminal mob.
And you could see Jang Song-taek saying, why am I going to turn over my life's work to my snot-nosed 20-something nephew?
This is Big Brother. When the Japanese journalist Yoji Komi first reported on Kim Jong-nam's criticisms of the regime, the DPRK responded with fury, sending the prince into a brief hiding. Or, as Kim Jong-nam told Komi,
I just have to be careful.
But things eventually cooled over. Kim Jong-il was running the country. He still loved his son. So the risks of needling the regime were relatively low. But things were different when Komi published his book. Kim Jong-il was dead, and Kim Jong-un was now in charge. And nobody knew how he'd react to his brother's inflammatory comments. It didn't help that Kim Jong-nam had suggested that North Korea should liberalize its economy and claimed that the best hope for reform was not his little brother, but Uncle Chang. Michael Madden explains.
Jong probably had
different ideas as to what North Korea's economy should be doing. In a North Korean context, he was most likely a reformer.
In fact, Uncle Chang had a proven track record of nudging the country in new directions.
There's some evidence that there were certain relaxations of social policies in North Korea under Jong Song-taek's leadership of the internal security apparatus, a toleration of religious activities, both Christianity and shamanism. And there was a certain degree of clemency and pardon given to people who fled illegally into China to seek work, or to seek economic relief, or to seek food.
Uncle Chang's influence was very real. A little more than a decade earlier, Chang may have nudged Kim Jong-il toward reform. The supreme leader had adopted a new constitution, one that embraced, quote, prime costs, prices, and profits. Profits? Now, that wasn't very communist. Neither was a new constitutional article calling for, quote, enterprises with corporations or individuals of foreign countries. The foreign country being Uncle Chang's friend, China.
Jong was very much aligned with China. Whereby Chinese investment money would come into North Korean economic sites.
Years later, Chang even pushed to create multiple economic zones along the border, miniature capitalist fiefdoms that functioned as incubators for innovation. Kim Jong-un actually embraced these ideas. The country created more than a dozen of them. On that, here's Jenny Town of the Simpson Center.
Kim Jong-un has really tried to put himself out as trying to usher in an era of economic prosperity and not just survival. There was a real emphasis on these special economic zones. North Korea was willing to do a lot of interesting things and created, you know, the legal space for these zones to develop.
Kim Jong-un also allowed the country's private black markets to blossom. Since then, this black market economy has grown into a legitimate practice, with many towns hosting government-approved marketplaces.
In terms of the actual market activity in the economy itself, there's been rising economic activity, and it's under the Kim Jong-un era.
Today, there are private grocers, private restaurants, private travel companies, and even private taxis, all competing for customers. By 2017, at least 40% of North Korea's population was running or working for some sort of private enterprise. And experts agree, the standard of living has increased.
There has been a real rise in accumulated wealth per person. Then there's been some, you know, medium size to larger size businesses that have flourished in the past few years. What you've also seen is a real loosening of control over like the state-owned enterprises.
This, of course, is not the Chinese-style reform Uncle Chang and Kim Jong-nam advocated for. But it's something. It's almost as if the two men were given the freedom to whisper into Kim Jong-un's ear. Perhaps Yoji Komi's book, full of Kim Jong-nam's proddings and the aged wisdom of Uncle Chang, actually made an impression on the young dictator. That's one interpretation. The other? Simply, times are tough in North Korea. But by allowing these markets to exist, Kim Jong-un has marginally boosted the standard of living and boosted his own popularity. The decision was ultimately self-serving. Besides, there's an economic benefit to letting private enterprises operate under the surface. The state can devote fewer funds to social institutions and spend more on its real priorities, like nuclear weapons. Indeed, since the rise of the private economy, the regime has been pouring more resources into money-making schemes and less into its people. And that's where the fates of Kim Jong-nam and Uncle Chang Sung-taek become tangled and messy. Because Kim Jong-nam's death? It might have nothing to do with the successorship. It might have nothing to do with dueling families or deceitful stepmothers. Their deaths might have everything to do with money.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
It took 11 years to get to this sale. The NYX Anniversary Sale is on now at knix.com. Celebrate the intimate apparel company that has reinvented products for real life with one of NYX's biggest sales of the year. Get 30% off all leak-proof apparel from the number one leak-proof brand in North America, including period underwear, swimwear, activewear, and more. Millions of people have made the switch to NYX leak-proof underwear, and there's never been a better time for you to try. Save 30% on super comfortable, machine washable, and great looking underwear that's perfect for periods and light bladder leaks. Choose from a variety of colors, styles, and sizes, from extra small to 4XL. You can even match your leak-proof underwear with an incredibly supportive and comfortable NYX wireless bra. Don't miss this chance to stock up on your NYX favorites or try something new. It only happens once a year at NYX.com. That's KNIX.com for the NYX Anniversary Sale. Hurry, the sale ends on Monday, May 13th. Go to NYX.com. That's KNIX.com.
There are lots of theories as to why Kim Jong-nam was assassinated. His Paektu blood was a threat to Kim Jong-un's power. He had argued for reform and opening up. He publicly criticized and embarrassed the regime by speaking to journalists. But there's another theory, and to understand it, you have to know a little about how North Korea makes money. The country has a diverse portfolio. Each year, it sends tens of thousands of migrant laborers, construction workers, loggers, farmers, to countries like Kuwait, Botswana, and even Poland. These indentured servants send the majority of their paychecks back to the regime. The country also boasts a small manufacturing sector. In the 70s and 80s, North Korea was one of the biggest makers and exporters of pachinko gambling machines in Asia. They sold many of these popular systems to the Yakuza. But selling gambling games to an organized crime syndicate is relatively above board compared to their other dirty money dealings. Deep inside the concrete bunkers of Pyongyang, a secret government bureau called Room 39 manages hundreds of illicit money-making schemes, from human trafficking to money laundering to rhinoceros horn smuggling.
I would say the North Korean leaders are very good at weaponizing their own weirdness.
That, again, is Dr. Sung-Yoon Lee of Tufts University.
They do these strange things, the state sponsoring illegal activities, not only weapons proliferation, but the production of fake famous brand cigarettes like Marlboro and other brands.
The North Korean regime is a king among counterfeiters. Cigarettes, handbags, sneakers, watches, you name it, they make it. And in the late 90s and early 2000s, they were the world's leader at pumping out convincingly real $100 bills called super dollars. And that helped them peddle drugs. Lots of them.
They sell drugs. This is the state, not just criminal gangs inside North Korea, but the state sponsoring all these illicit activities.
North Korea ships heroin to places like Australia and smuggles counterfeit prescription drugs to Bulgaria. It supplies 40% of Japan's methamphetamine, with some high-quality crystal meth landing in the U.S. One of North Korea's most ingenious money-making methods, however, revolves around a vast network of diplomats and international residents, people like Kim Jong-nam and Chang Sung-taek.
North Korean diplomats stationed abroad have really behaved like an official criminal mob under the guise of diplomatic immunity, engaging in criminal activities for profit.
That's because North Korea's diplomats and foreign elites are responsible for earning money for the regime, often using diplomatic immunity as a cover. Here again is Michael Madden.
Originally, North Korea
did a lot of these transactions through their embassy, but the original idea in 1974 was to sell drugs and gold. There's very strict controls about selling gold, and the way to avoid that was through the diplomatic black bag, which is to say, diplomats have immunity. And the diplomats' luggage and briefcases cannot be inspected by customs officials. So, North Korea decided to sell gold and brought opium to be processed in 1974. And the man who had that bright idea to use the diplomatic black bag was a young North Korean official named Jang Song-taek.
Since then, these money-making techniques have only gotten more sophisticated.
The leaders say, you guys go into business for yourselves. You get your own export-import network on your own book. And as long as you just turn the money over to me, then we won't have a problem. This is a little bit like the mafia, where they have to kick up the money for the regime.
And that may be what ultimately got Kim Jong-nam in trouble. Because as times got tight and quotas got harder to hit, North Korean elites may have started eyeing each other's money ventures.
And there was a competition, almost a feeding.
There was a competition, almost a feeding frenzy, among North Korean elites trying to earn foreign currency because it ingratiates you to the leader.
For North Korean elites, there was an arms race to make money. And if Kim Jong-nam had one advantage above the rest, it's that he lived in a place where money, clean and dirty, was easy to make and even easier to hide. Macau. In 2004, American law enforcement agencies discovered that Chinese gangs were smuggling North Korean-made counterfeits, fake currency, fake cigarettes, and even fake Viagra into the port of Newark, New Jersey. What followed is a masterclass in espionage. Two American spies, undercover as an engaged couple, infiltrated the criminal network. They began helping the groups transport containers of counterfeit goods past U.S. customs, such as narcotics, and even surface-to-air missiles. After winning the smugglers' trust, the lovebirds invited them to a fake wedding on a yacht off the coast of Atlantic City. The criminals came to America and stepped inside limousines that, according to the wedding invitation, would take them to the ceremony. Inside the limousines, tuxedo-clad FBI agents. The entire operation led to the indictment of 87 suspects. But the biggest surprise came when secret agents followed the money. It led straight to the shining city on the Pearl River Delta, Macau. Within a year, investigators had discovered that nearly every bank in Macau was laundering super dollars for the North Korean regime. Big banks, little banks, it didn't matter. Almost all were involved. Even the local branch of the Bank of China, the fifth largest bank on the planet, was allegedly laundering counterfeit money. When it came time to slap Macau's banks with penalties, the U.S. Department of Justice ultimately decided to leave the bigger institutions, like the Bank of China, alone, presumably to avoid triggering a global economic catastrophe. Instead, it targeted one small, family-owned institution called Banco Delta Asia. Sanctions rained down on the tiny bank. Suddenly, the institution could no longer deal in U.S. currency, essentially locking it out of the global economy. The bank froze all of its accounts linked to North Korea. Out of fear of being next, so did every other bank in Macau. According to congressional testimony, the freeze worked. North Korea's production lines ground to a halt. Even the famously dodgy government of Macau instituted a ream of new money laundering laws, forcing North Korea's criminal elements to find new ways to bank their cash. By this point, Kim Jong-nam had been living in Macau for at least 5 years. No evidence, however, has ever tied him to the laundering scheme.
I don't know whether he was involved in the Banco Delta Asia situation, but I think the reasons for both of these things, for Kim Jong-nam being there and for Banco Delta Asia being a conduit for North Korea, all rest on the fact that Macau was a pretty opaque place.
It's difficult, however, to believe that the son of North Korea's ruler, once the assumed heir to the whole regime, would be unaware what his dad was doing at his neighborhood bank. In fact, reports suggest that Kim Jong-nam had access to a substantial cache of counterfeit superdollars. And shortly after the Banco Delta Asia scandal, it appears that Kim Jong-nam began searching for novel ways to make and hide large sums of money. And in the process, he might have helped make North Korea one of the most dangerous and powerful countries on the planet. In the early 2000s, when Kim Jong-nam was comfortably settled in Macau, North Korea began to pivot from physical counterfeiting and smuggling to cybercrime. This, of course, is one of the great ironies of North Korea. Few citizens there have access to a computer. Those who do are heavily surveilled, with screenshots taken of their activity every time an app is opened. Instead of the internet, most only have access to an intranet network called Kwangmyeong, meaning bright light, which gives access to up to 5,000 state-approved websites. only the elite have access to the open internet. And yet, despite this technological repression, North Korea is home to some of the most obscenely talented computer technicians on the planet. More than 7,000 North Koreans work in the country's cyber army, and they start early.
You know, North Korean hackers are...
North Korean hackers are recruited at about 10 years old. So you get a young person that's really good at computer systems, especially computer coding. North Korea finds them when they're in late elementary school. That's where they find their cyber warriors. North Korea does that with gymnasts as well, and figure skaters and piano players. There's not a great difference in their respective systems. You have an aptitude for a certain subject. That's basically what you're going to do for the rest of your life.
Indeed, according to the journalist Ed Caesar of The New Yorker, students from Kim Il-sung University and the Kim Chaek University of Technology often, quote, outperform American and Chinese colleges in the International Collegiate Programming Contest. Year after year, North Korean students compete at the highest levels at the International Mathematical Olympiad. Here again is Jenny Town.
North Korea's cyber capabilities have really grown over the years and grown to be very adept and very sophisticated. The types of cyber crimes that we've seen have been pretty elaborate. We've even seen in their intelligence gathering side a real growth in the sophistication of how they try to do different like phishing campaigns. So it is a real and a formidable force and a real growing part of North Korea's economic strategy.
Under names like the Beagle Boys, the Lazarus Group, and New Romantic, North Korea's Enemy Collapse Sabotage Bureau, yep, that's its name, have infected computers in more than 150 countries where they've robbed banks, held organizations for ransom, and hacked ATMs. North Korea's computer wizards have digitally laundered money in the Philippines and have cryptojacked, that is, stolen, more than $1.75 billion in cryptocurrency. They've even breached the servers of the South Korean army, obtaining the military plans of their neighboring enemy. This is Kim Jong-nam's legacy in North Korea, and for that matter, the world.
Go and track Kim Jong-nam.
If we go and track Kim Jong-nam at the Korean Computer Center from around 1995 to 1998, they're importing computers into the country. They're importing computers into North Korean schools. Those are the tools they eventually use for recruiting hackers. Kim Jong-nam is essentially responsible for a lot of the computer hardware that the cyber warriors trained on in the 90s and the early 2000s.
Kim Jong-nam planted the seeds for North Korea's vast and powerful network of hackers. And not only that, he might have been actively supporting these activities from his home in Macau. Shortly after the Banco Delta fiasco, Kim Jong-nam visited the Shangri-La Hotel in Bangkok and met with an expert in internet security. Jong-nam used a false name, introducing himself as Johnny Kim, and explained that he was running a business and he needed an IT specialist who could protect his servers. Unaware of Johnny Kim's real identity and unsure of the nature of his work, the internet expert agreed to take the job. The same man who would anonymously discuss these details with Anna Fifield told her that something was fishy about the man called Johnny Kim.
He described going around places in Southeast Asia together with Kim Jong-nam and just talked about how security conscious he was. He always walked down back alleys and places where he knew that there wouldn't be security cameras. He was always on the lookout for Japanese people in particular because Japanese journalists had been so aggressive or active in trying to track him down and talk to him. So he was someone who very much had his wits about him.
Even as a manager, Kim Jong-nam was secretive. The internet expert was paid in $100 bills, later revealed to be counterfeit superdollars. The man was paired with two cyber specialists, both of them apparently North Koreans. Eventually, the internet expert learned that Kim's so-called business was actually dozens upon dozens of gambling websites. Online gambling is an easy way to launder money. It's virtual, there's high cash flow coming from across the globe, and there are significant profit margins. By running not just one, but dozens of gambling sites, it's believed that Kim Jong-nam could spread illegal and counterfeit funds around, diluting suspicious activity. And this suggests a tantalizing theory. When North Korea could no longer launder physical dollars in Macau's bank, did it find a workaround by embracing the murky world of internet gambling? And was Kim Jong-nam the mastermind behind it? And more to the point, if he was making money this way, was he keeping it for himself or sending it back to the regime?
There are also plenty of suggestions that he was still in cahoots with the regime, whether it was sending money back, raising money for the regime, or for his uncle, Jang Sung-taek, who he was very close to.
Were Jang Sung-taek and Kim Jong-nam working together to launder money? Was Kim Jong-nam sent to Macau not to satisfy his capitalist playboy lifestyle, but because it was the kind of place where he could exploit capitalism?
This was a place where he was able to do a lot of his business, including potentially running computing or tech businesses for the North Korean regime. There have been suggestions over the years that he was running the Korea Computer Center and involved in a lot of cyber activities, either on behalf of the North Korean regime or on his own behalf there.
We don't have solid answers to these questions. Kim Jong-nam might have had access to millions of dollars at a time when other North Korean elites were desperate to make money for the regime. And as one of our sources, who agreed to speak on background, suggested, there's another layer to this tantalizing theory. Kim Jong-nam's online businesses were much more than just fronts to make money. They were also backdoors to order and procure equipment for the regime. That is, when North Korea couldn't import an item because of sanctions, Kim Jong-nam, from the safety of southern China, could use his online businesses to procure it for them. And according to our source, he used that loophole to buy gadgets and tech that could be used to fuel North Korea's cyber warfare division. Then Kim Jong-nam was not living a life of exile in Macau. He was actively helping build up one of the regime's most notorious and now dangerous divisions. In other words, Kim Jong-nam had power, and that might have stoked the ire of other North Korean elites who were not only jealous of the connections he had, but also struggling to make their payments to the regime. They probably wanted to get their hands on his secret recipe. But from his capitalist perch in Macau, Kim Jong-nam saw no reason to share it. So maybe they wanted to take it from him.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
It took 11 years to get to this sale. The Knix Anniversary Sale is on now at knix.com. Celebrate the intimate apparel company that has reinvented products for real life with one of Knix's biggest sales of the year. Get 30% off all leak-proof apparel from the number one leak-proof brand in North America, including period underwear, swimwear, activewear, and more. Millions of people have made the switch to Knix leak-proof underwear, and there's never been a better time for you to try.
save 30% on super comfortable, machine washable, and great looking underwear that's perfect for periods and light bladder leaks. Choose from a variety of colors, styles, and sizes, from extra small to 4XL. You can even match your leak-proof underwear with an incredibly supportive and comfortable Knix wireless bra. Don't miss this chance to stock up on your Knix favorites or try something new. It only happens once a year at Knix.com. That's KNIX.com for the Knix Anniversary Sale. Hurry, the sale ends on Monday, May 13th. Go to Knix.com. That's KNIX.com.
We had to learn more about this theory. Was it possible that Kim Jong-nam's death was, in fact, sparked not by Kim Jong-un, but by jealous North Korean elites desperate to get their hands on his money-making software? The theory does make some sense. After all, there were at least two attempts on Kim Jong-nam's life in the years prior, long before Kim Jong-un held any power. It's extremely unlikely his father, when he was in control, had ordered these hits. So who did? Was someone trying to clear the path to the throne? Or were they trying to get their hands on his money? Or were they after this tantalizing software that he, and only he, controlled? We tried to corroborate our anonymous sources' claims, but most experts we interviewed couldn't confirm it. However, they didn't rule it out either.
My name is Soo Kim. I'm a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. I was a CIA analyst on North Korea.
Soo Kim has thought about these possibilities. Could someone else have ordered the hit on Kim Jong-nam, whether on their own or maybe as a favor to the new supreme leader?
Absolutely possible, I would say, that for senior North Korean officials to want to do this as a quote-unquote favor, but I think this would have to be approved by Kim Jong-un, because not just because of maybe high stakes involved in terms of, you know, killing a family member, but because there's potential backlash. I think up to a certain point, yes, it's possible. But then again, keep in mind that decisions, authority, it's all resting on Kim Jong-un.
So very likely, Kim Jong-un had to at least approve the hit. But that's not the same as ordering the hit. And as Kim Jong-un had proven before, he wasn't afraid to do that. That takes us back to the beginning of this episode, when Kim Jong-un was masquerading as a Brazilian boy called Joseph Puig. While studying in Switzerland, Kim Jong-un fell in love with the snow and the mountains. He learned how to ski and spent weekends at resorts outside the city of Bern. When he became supreme leader, Kim Jong-un was determined to bring these places to North Korea. So, about a year and a half into his regime, Kim Jong-un told Chang Sung-taek that he wanted to build both a ski resort and a water park. According to the testimony of a defector, this is where Uncle Chang first slipped. He suggested that the young ruler should focus on the economy before he ventured to build a water park. Kim Jong-un did not take this suggestion well. We don't know what happened behind the palace walls, but it's reasonable to assume that Kim Jong-un argued that building a luxury resort was building up the economy. Because in 2006, the United Nations targeted North Korea with sanctions, hitting nearly every sector of its economy, with the exception of tourism.
Tourism has been a very big part also of how the state makes money. And these were special zones for inter-Korean tourism. And there was actually a lot of activity that went on between them. There's a real rise in tourism from China. And you saw a real emphasis and investment in creating more attractive tourist destinations. So different hot springs, you know, the buildup of the beach resort at Wonsan over the years, the Masigurang ski resort.
So what Uncle Chang saw as wasteful spending on piddling pleasure resorts was in fact, in Kim Jong-un's mind at least, an investment, a way to make much-needed money in a legitimate way. It was also a way to convince citizens that life was indeed getting better. But Chang's opposition made Kim Jong-un skeptical of his father's old number two.
And so he's looking around. He's looking around.
He's looking at these grizzled 65, 75-year-old North Korean officials. He's looking to see who's going to be loyal and who's going to form an alternative power center. Who's going to be a threat to his consolidation of power? That's where Jong Song Tech starts to loom large.
Eventually, Uncle Jang complied. And within a few years, as North Korea plunged into another food crisis, Kim Jong-un would proudly unveil the Masikryong Ski Resort and the Munsu Water Park. He'd construct a dolphin aquarium and develop the sandy beachfront around the royal compound in Wonsan, with department stores, golf courses, beach resorts, and missile launch pads. But according to defectors, Kim Jong-un and Uncle Jang's relationship never recovered.
And he started to undermine his nephew.
And we have to look at it from the perspective of Jong Song Tech. Jong Song Tech is a man in his late 60s. He had been in the center of North Korea power going back to the 1970s. He had fallen in and out of favor, and so you could see Jong Song Tech being 65, 66 years old in 2011, and said, why am I going to turn over all of this power? Why am I going to turn over my life's work to my snot-nosed 20-something nephew? Maybe there is a degree of resentment in that. And so that starts to form these tensions.
Things got even testier when the dear leader ordered Chang to relinquish control of a condensed milk factory and a fish farm. Apparently, members of the government loyal to Chang blocked the transition when Kim Jong-un's men came to take over. Some say that was the last straw. Others suggest that Kim Jong-un had discovered Uncle Chang's secret. That in 2008, when Kim Jong-il was recovering from a stroke, Chang had been pushing, unsuccessfully, to have Kim Jong-nam chosen as the next successor. Chang Sung-taek, in other words, was a traitor to Kim Jong-un from the start.
Kim Jong-un sort of had to put his uncle down because his uncle was undermining him.
In late 2013, Uncle Chang was escorted to the Kangon Military Academy, where two of his closest deputies, and arguably two of his closest friends, were trotted in front of anti-aircraft machine guns. The weapons, designed to pierce the steel fuselage of airplanes, turned the men into pulp. Their remains were incinerated with flamethrowers. Uncle Chang immediately fainted. Chang had survived purges before. He had been demoted in the past and even sent to re-education camps. But when Kim Jong-il was in charge, he was always considered family, an accordion-playing goofball on the other side of the dining table. But this was a new time, and Uncle Chang's behavior was a tangible threat for the new supreme leader.
Undermining him in a way...
Jong Song Tech was undermining him in a way that really not only threatened Kim Jong-un as a political figure, but probably threatened Kim Jong-un's life. He was probably the only person in North Korea's political culture that could foment an assassination against his nephew. Jong Song-taek was the only one who had the intelligence and the personality and the connections to be able to make the morning after the coup successful.
On December 8, 2013, about a week after his friends were executed, Chang was accused of dozens of charges. Namely, he had been planting his followers in key posts and had, quote, worked to stretch his tentacles even to the People's Army with a foolish calculation that he would succeed in staging a coup. Other charges seemed more petty and ridiculous. He was accused of clapping for the new leader, quote, half-heartedly. A photograph of him leaning on an armrest during a speech, a bored expression on his face, was used to prove his disloyalty. Kim Jong-un was unsparing. He described Uncle Chang as, quote, despicable human scum who was worse than a dog. Only a week passed between Chang's arrest and his sentencing. He was taken from the courtroom to the Kangon military training area, and just like his deputies before him, told to kneel in front of an anti-aircraft gun. The death of Uncle Chang would be a wake-up call. It didn't matter how loyal you were to Kim Jong-un's father. It didn't matter how well you helped the transition of power. It didn't matter if you had good ideas about the economy. And it didn't matter that years earlier, your passport said you were father and son.
It really did send a message to not only Jang Song-taek's faction as to this is not your house, this is my house, and you need to fall in line. Like, I might be young, but I still am decisive and can be brutal.
In other words, if you dissent, you die. After Uncle Chang's death, Kim Jong-un proudly stated, "Our party detected and purged the anti-party counter-revolutionary factionalists." His uncle's friends were quickly replaced from their posts. Dozens of his closest family members were sent to prison camps. Defector testimony suggests that more than 30 of Uncle Chang's associates, including family, would be killed by firing squad. But by the end of 2013, one of Uncle Chang's closest associates, confidants, and friends was out there, still alive. Kim Jong-nam. On the next Big Brother, how North Korea's relationship with the United States may have contributed to Kim Jong-nam's death in more ways than one. Big Brother is a production of School of Humans and iHeartRadio and hosted by me, Eden Lee. Lucas Riley is our writer, co-director, and associate producer. Amelia Brock is our senior producer, co-director, and editor. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Brandon Barr, Elsie Crowley, and Jason English. Our fact checker is Aaron Blakemore. Music composed by Jason Todd Shannon and Tune Wilders. Original score mix by Vic Stafford. Audio editing by Jesse Neiswanger. Sound design and mix by Harper W. Harris. Audio correction by Josh Fisher. Voice acting by Mark Chung and Mike Coscarelli. Special thanks to Ryan Murdoch and Will Pearson. If you're enjoying the podcast, help us get the word out by leaving a rating in your favorite podcast app. Until next time, I'm Eden Lee.
School of Humans.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Ocean by H10 Hotels and do your deal at CheapCaribbean.com.